Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
On today's Indie Opera Podcast, Houston, we have a problem. The issue of story and structure in new opera. Also on today's podcast,
Marshall splits me with thunder, bursting waves of
we have a conversation with Niloufar Talibi, resident artist with American Lyric Theater and librettist for The Disinherited, part of a four-part opera with four different composers. Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter.
And this is Noah.
And this is Brooke.
And we're recording this show for a second time because we had a technical problem last week. And so we're going to do this again.
All right.
And should we pretend that it never happened?
Well, I don't think we can do that because we just told the audience. Yeah. Just told the audience.
We'll just let it go wherever it goes.
We tipped our hand.
If it goes into new territory, it goes into new territory.
Well, inevitably will. You know?
So let's talk about what we've seen since our last show, which was a while ago.
Yeah.
We should talk about the Prototype Festival since we were talking about previewing it.
That's right. You saw six or something. Didn't you see a bunch? Saw a whole bunch.
I saw a whole bunch. That's a good question. I saw one, two, three, four of them.
That's a lot.
What did you see, Brooke? Did you see any of them?
I did, and I'm drawing a blank on which one I saw. It was the one that was about what is it? I'm looking at the
Thumbprint?
I'm sorry.
Did you see Thumbprint?
Thumbprint is the one that's about the girl, the Palestinian woman. Yes.
That's Kamala Santaram.
That's the one I saw.
I didn't get to see that one. Tell me about it.
It was really cool. I really enjoyed it. And I think, I think that was her first opera.
Yes, it was.
Is extremely impressive. She's a singer. Go ahead.
What made it cool?
Well, the topic was cool. I mean, it's an interesting, modern, relevant thing.
Tell us.
It's about... it's about a woman who goes I'm gonna misrepresent this story.
That's not new for the podcast.
You must be brave. You must take it brave.
Okay.
The last podcast I described Paul's case completely wrong. So that's
okay.
Fine.
That's why you have to just go.
So Thumbprint is about a woman whose brother is accused of raping a girl from the next town over, and he hasn't, but he's been accused of it. And so she has to go and beg forgiveness for him and is subjected to being raped herself in, sort of as like a eye for an eye sort of thing. And this
is what's the like time or what's
it's modern. I mean, it's based on a real person,
but where in the
Pakistan
world? Oh, okay. So is this, it's so then why is she forced to go?
Because that's what you, it's what
it's
you
just
do.
Part of the culture.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find more information. So she is gang raped as retribution for an honor crime her brother allegedly committed.
Wait, so then he didn't rape, he honor crimed?
Well, no, I mean, he was accused of an honor crime.
Okay. That he What's didn't an honor commit. Crime?
Something like he did something to ruin another girl's honor. So he kissed her, or he talked to her, or he, you know, I don't remember exactly.
Okay. And you didn't see that on, like, it didn't.
No, they don't show that really. There's a series of, there's a narrative, but it's a sort of a series of vignettes. So you don't necessarily get all of the connecting pieces.
Right.
And granted this, you know, this was January. So, and now it's April. So it's been a while, but,
don't say that. Say it's fresh in your memory.
It's just, fresh just in my memory.
Live.
No, I remember it. I mean, I remember being really struck by it. And it's about Mukhtar Mai, who is modern. You know, she's a modern woman. And she then speaks out against this woman does. And so the composer took this topic, which is a modern topic, and wrote an opera about it. And the music, it's a really interesting score, and the performances were quite good. They had some really great singers, and it's a really compelling story. And I don't think it's a finished product yet, but it's a really great, there's a lot of potential for this piece.
And how long was it?
I feel like it was about an hour. Maybe there was a lot of sort of Arabic influence in the music. It's sort of a mix between Western styles and Eastern styles. So it was a really interesting mix of these two sort of musical styles.
Cool. So,
yeah, it was really great.
So now I'm going to get into my little beef, all right?
Okay. Beef. Where's the
So
beef?
How was the storytelling? Was it first person narrative, or was it very distant? Tell me how the story moved forward.
So what I remember of it was that they made they had this really cool set that was designed. They had these, it's sort of benches that they were able to sort of move around the stage and use in various ways. I found that there was a pretty good narrative in this particular piece. And we've discussed that that's not often the case. But the composer is a singer at first, or she was a singer first. So she, at least I think she was. So she, and she actually sang the leading role. So she has a good sense of, from experiential knowledge of drama. There was a sense of connectivity from the beginning to the end. And I did feel like there was a sense of drama. The story was told, like the main character was Mukhtar Mai, and she sort of told the story. So there was a series of soliloquies of sorts. But there was also a fair amount of action going on, and they used the set in a really cool way to sort of symbolize motion, because they had to travel quite a lot in this story. So I found it to be effective dramatically. It wasn't staid. Something did happen. The story did start and end, and there was sort of a trajectory for the drama.
Okay, so now I'm going to go into my beef. Is that all right?
Yes. Yes.
So I went and saw Paul's Case, which I think is a story based on a Will Cather short story, about a boy who they didn't probably name it back then, have ADD. seriously, or some sort of dissociative maybe.
Behavior.
Whoa. ADD is not disassociative.
Oh, and then what? Let me, maybe not ADD. What word should I use?
Well, I don't know. Well, what disassociative meaning? Like schizophrenia? Like you're not matching up with what's going on in reality?
Maybe.
So describe.
We don't see the problem.
What are the symptoms? What are the symptoms?
Not being,
you'd be like the worst. You would not get in my community production of Dr. House the musical. You would not make it.
I've been watching that in marathon.
Oh, I love that stupid show.
It's on Netflix now. So I've been watching it like compulsively the past, I don't know, 2 weeks.
Have you noticed the theme song? They took the theme song out, I think.
It's wrong. It's not right.
It must be a rights issue.
You're talking about the theme song to House?
The House is this, it's a weird choice. It's this group from the 90s, Massive Attack, like this kind of, I don't know, what would you call it? Kind of like techno, but
yeah.
I think it has a more specific like Manc, like Northern Manc tech, Northern Manc house or something. Anyway, so like they're, and it's like, that was kind of cool as a theme song for this show set in Jersey. And then I think Netflix had to edit it out because I think probably they couldn't get the rights.
Yeah, it's I keep hearing it and being like, that's not the right theme song. What's wrong with this?
All right, let's,
weird.
All right, I'm going to get back to Paul's
case.
So maybe, you know, and that's, this is my problem. You don't know what the kid has. And it's not even stated very clearly. It's a form of autism, or maybe.
Well, what do you? What? Give it, tell the symptoms, and we can help diagnose.
He doesn't seem to be able to deal with people socially. Focus on anything. He fails from school. Fails in school because he can't concentrate on, you know, what's going on. But you don't really know, and that's part of the problem with this that I have. The storytelling in this particular piece. Now, the music was gorgeous. It was a minimalist score. I mean, it would stay in one tonal center for awfully long. But I didn't mind it because of Kevin Newbery's staging was so inventive. People would repeat things, though, over and over. And it wouldn't be like the repeating bits of conversation. One of the singers would sing, I am a teacher. You know what I mean? Things that don't even forward the story. So it was very sort of disassociative, whatever what was going on. It might have been a form of autism, perhaps?
Yeah, it sounds like it was, because autism is a spectrum disorder, you know, we always hear that. So it's like, that's a safe bet, because like lots of situations, I think, look like autism. Or like lots of different kinds of behaviors fall under autistic rubric or whatever.
Right, and the...
we'd have to ask Dr. House.
That's right. it was very difficult to actually follow exactly or know what was wrong, but you get the impressions of what was going on.
And when was this set?
Oh, good question. Let's see. He goes to New York and he gets probably in the turn of the century.
So not a good time for mental illness.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. And he ends up hooking up with this guy and
like cruising?
Yeah, and he ends up bringing him back to his hotel room. And
how old is he?
He's probably, you know, he's failing out of high school, and he steals money from his father and runs to New York, and basically, I mean, it's a tragic ending, but beautifully staged. At the end of the show, where he's burying something under the ice. But there was this large set of lights across the top of the theater, and they slowly sank down, the entire grid of lights down towards the stage. It was just really beautiful visually. So this basically got the best possible production values for a piece. It was gorgeous. And basically for all of the Prototype Festival, one thing you can say is that Beth Morrison really gives these new artists the absolute best platform and the slickest, so they get the best presentation that they can get. There's really, there's nothing lacking. The musicianship, the orchestras on all the pieces were just blazingly amazing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree?
I was gonna, you know, we're eventually gonna get around to talking about Have a Nice Day.
Yes.
So which I thought, one, before we even talk about all of the things about it, like, it just looked like it was really inexpensive and like really economic. I mean, look, how much did it cost to even put that on? You know?
Yeah, all you needed was costumes. fluorescent lights, and then those little scanners that beep.
Yeah.
That let's talk about the story a little.
And a space piano. Yeah.
So it's set in Lithuania, and they're supposed to be cash checkout girls, I guess, at cash registers.
Like a Walmart, Lithuania.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the piece has this sort of minimalist feeling as well, but also influenced by sort of folk scales and lots of repetitive rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying the words very, very quickly, all together in these beautiful harmonic chords that sort of undulate. It was gorgeous. And there is no story. It's sort of it's almost like a series of meditations as well.
But it was a bunch of different stories, right? Right. There was stories about. I know they weren't like huge tragic epic stories. It wasn't like, oh, there was a guy and he came in and took everybody hostage. But it was like there were people talking about what it was like to be bored and what it was like to want to travel. Or I think there was
I would call it chatter. I would call it chatter. They talk about chatter.
Sure, but except I think that we're supposed to take their chatter very, very seriously as the drama of this work, you know, like that's kind of the meat, which was what I thought was most admirable about it was because that's an interesting thing to do, you know?
Yeah. Now there was a basic trend though of non-linear narrative throughout the festival, but it has made me think that maybe this is also a larger issue in the opera community recently, where a lot of operas aren't really non-linear narratives, and they're almost a meditation on.
I think it's a broader problem with any storytelling medium that is temporal, because if you have like let's say like you know film, theater, anything that takes place on a time scale, you do have a choice to actually tell a story that is going to make sense and happen in the kind of temporal constraints that an audience can understand, or you do have other choices available to like stop time or repeat things, or you know, like not stop time, but give the impression that there isn't the same kind of trappings that we live in right. terms of time. So I think it's like, and novels, you know, even anything that deals with time, any art that deals with time in this way has this as its basis, as an issue, you know, especially now.
Right. And for me, I'm gonna tell a stupid story. Do you ever read the book Dune?
Yeah.
All right. So I loved the book Dune when I was younger, and then they made a movie out of it. Did you see that?
I have
seen part of it.
So Dune the movie is one of the biggest heartbreaking movies ever, I think.
Because it was so bad.
Well, because I enjoy really that movie, a lot of that movie, but I just can't say that it's a great movie, and I can understand why people hate it and why they're frustrated with it, but it is kind of gorgeous, and it has some really amazing things in it, but it's not at all as good as the book, of course, and it's David Lynch, and it looks like David Lynch struggling, not being able to do what he does well.
And I'll tell you why I disliked it. Because you never felt that you were ever in the present moment. You always felt like it was a Cliff's Notes. Like you never really sat down and felt like, all right, I'm here and this is happening.
I know exactly what you mean.
Do you know what I mean?
I think that was I didn't feel like that about that movie so much, but I felt like that about things like Lord of the Rings and a lot of movies based on books where it's like a tour. It's like a cinematic tour of the moments of the book so that people who are blowhards can sit there with their checklist and go, good. You know what I mean? Like, and get them all and capture them all like Pokemon.
Right.
It's just, yeah.
As opposed to taking you on a journey as an audience member.
Exactly.
Or choosing one section of the book or choosing to do the, you know, like I'm obsessed with this movie that I'm going to, and I think it relates to both things we're talking about, this movie called Satan's Tango from 1994. it's 7.5 hours long, which sounds horrible. But the thing is, it's kind of like Wagner in the sense that because his storytelling is so slow, he's actually not telling that complicated of a story. He's telling you a story that I could tell you in like 10 minutes, you know?
Right.
But, and so that makes it easy to not get lost and not be like, wait, who the hell is that? So that's that part of the film is easy. The hard part is sitting there watching the camera move through a field,
right,
and trying to kind of just take in the rain and the puddles and the cows and not, you know, turn it off and do something that's way more satisfying visually. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think it has to do with time, right? Because it's like it's telling you to sit and to kind of take something in at a certain time. And it's also telling you that your satisfaction with the normal time in which stories are told, right, is going to be suspended, you know?
Now, this is very interesting. Okay. So there's a certain point in any play, or no, I shouldn't say any play, in really well-structured narratives,
yeah,
where you feel when the play starts that there's exposition. You feel that you're being told facts, and you're seeing people relate. And then as they relate more and more, time becomes more and more relative to real time. And you start to feel like you're in existence at a certain moment. Now, a lot of things like Into the Woods, or, and I've mentioned this before, I'm trying to think of another one, but let's say Into the Woods. The moment where the baker and Little Red Riding Hood are sitting in the tree, and mm-hmm. they say, no one is alone, truly. Mm-hmm. You know that beautiful moment?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
You are not alone. Believe me, no one is alone.
No one is alone. Believe me.
Truly, you move just a finger. Say the slightest word. Something's bound to linger. Be heard.
No one.
That's the moment that I feel you all of a sudden, all this frenetic activity, all of a sudden you settle and you've arrived. And then,
and
that's the moment right before the climax comes where you feel, all right, this is what we've been waiting for. We're now all present. There's often a moment in an opera, the great diva aria, where everything holds still. Time, you get to the spot, everything leads up to it, and you've arrived. That sort of a moment is what I missed. I didn't feel that way in any of the things I saw at Prototype, and in a lot of the recent operas that I've seen.
I really particularly like this way that you, this criticism of yours, because I think you're right. Like, I felt this way about a lot of operas that, and films. It's that, Karen has a really good expression for this, but she uses this expression for like pop songs that don't work.
Okay.
Which is that, so we're like, whenever we're listening to a pop song and like it doesn't work, she'll be like, or not, she doesn't do this all the time because it would be maddening, but she did it once and it was really funny. She said, it's like the lid never comes off.
Right. You've mentioned that.
You know, I love that. It's like the food comes, but the lid doesn't. You know, it's like, it's just, it doesn't quite go anywhere.
So are you missing the trajectory, or are you missing the stasis of that moment, or both?
Well, it's actually, a good composer, what they do is they set up, even their tonal structure, the tensions release at this moment where you become present.
Right.
Or dramatically.
Or they can do it a bunch of different ways. Or they can do it like that, or they can do it the other way, which is to make the, like, tonally speaking, make the setup of the dominant, the stress of the situation, and then like the really big moment of transcendence happens in the dominant. So, you know, like, think about, you know what's really great? That aria from it would be cool if I just knew this. Wouldn't it? It's from...
Wow, you're getting like me.
No.
No?
No, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think of... Oh, there's this Mozart aria for soprano that everybody... You guys would know if I said it, like, right away. It's a cavatina.
Okay.
It's the Countess's cavatina, I think.
Borgia Amor?
Yes, Borgia Amor. Basically, if you look at it, has, I don't know, something like 12 measures in the tonic, and then most of the music happens in the dominant. but not in such a way that you're feeling like, oh my God, I'm going to pass out because it's so tense. He moves to the dominant, right? And then what he does is all of his kind of storytelling happens in the dominant, so that structurally, you know, you're going to go back to the tonic, but it doesn't matter because the home, the story of the aria is actually in the dominant chord or key with respect to where you're actually starting and beginning.
Right.
You know, so it's like stressing, but either way, I think what we're talking about is prolonging a moment, you know, like, and bringing out this stasis that arias and that moments that of dramatic sensibilities kind of happen, they have, because that's kind of how they work.
So now, wait a second, just for the people who may be listening who have absolutely no idea what we're talking about, tonic and dominant, there's really no way to explain it very quickly, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Ready?
Uh-oh. Okay.
You know when you hear the timpani playing at the end of a piece, all of a sudden you'll hear bum, 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 right?
Yeah, it's a surface phenomenon.
Yes, it is a surface phenomenon. But there's the tension you feel that the last note, there's a last note, and then there's a note that has an awful lot of tension. Bum, 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 boom. That the lower note is what would be on the fifth note of the scale. It's called the dominant. And then in a key, you can actually move from one key to another. So actually we start in the bum, and then you move your piece, you recompose, so that the middle section is the ba, and it feels like it needs to resolve back to the do or the tonic. That's what we're talking about for those. Is that a bad description?
No, it's good. I just always try to give a more broad description and say, like, when people talk about tonic and dominant, they're talking about the two, like, poles, harmonic poles by which all harmonies are ordered, you know?
Cool. And for those who are listening, you can write us and tell us who explained it better.
Yeah, that's better. But you did very well.
I used colloquial. No, I didn't use colloquial. I used vernacular. That's all.
It's tricky because I always feel really guarded when the subject of harmony comes up, because I felt like I cracked that nut very late in my, as a musician. Like, I really only started understanding or thinking deeply harmonically at like 22, 23. And then once I kind of looked at music like that, I never went back. And So I kind of was angry at my, at functional bass note theory training, because it taught me to look at just chords and to like not really think in terms of behavior or music that has, you know.
Well, the idea of stasis, though, an arrival, idea of you've gotten somewhere and you've finally come, and often that's accompanied with, I've come to care for these characters or understand them, you know?
Yeah.
And that the tension has finally built where then it gets released in this wonderful climax, right? This is the thing that I think is not getting handled very well by a lot of young composers.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also one of the things that the prototype is so great for, is that you get to see all these different kinds of work, and maybe the composers will also get to see how other people are handling the same material, because they don't study this in school. They're studying composition, and they're coming at this as we from a compositional side, right?
No, but you know what the problem is? That even when you do study this kind of stuff, at least the people I studied these kinds of things with, they give you the same thing in music. They give you a kind of taxonomic explanation of what's going on in stories, right? There's like, all right, so there's the villain and there's the hero, or there's like, the book is about this, it has this idea. No one really does, or at least in my education, I never had anyone who sufficiently could explain how or demonstrate how you could, you know, build drama in a scene, for lack of a better term, you know. And I have friends who could do it. I had friends who could go, look, it's like this. I would have like a guy do this and then this, and maybe you'd see this and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, why haven't I ever had a teacher that does that?
Well,
go ahead. I was going to say, how many composers are picking apart, or composition students are picking apart the work, the operas of Mozart and
Verdi? But I think that's the problem.
Most of the ones I knew.
Yeah. I think that's the problem. I think that they're looking at, let's say, the Mozart wonderful marriage of Figaro scenes, where he uses tension by using the keys, going through the circle of keys, and seeing how this key is related to this key, Which, yeah, I mean, that's all kind of true. But it isn't how to handle drama and how to build tension with the lyrics and how to really know when a lyric serves the drama well and how the music will actually move it forward. Just because it's you're studying Mozart and he used this device of the circle of fifths, well, that doesn't really explain the phenomenon.
Yeah, I have a good example, actually. Like, do we all know the opera Wozzeck?
Of course. Yes.
So I had a professor who I liked a lot, actually, at City College. And I took an opera class, which was maddening because it was like, I mean, I don't know why I just had to take this class. But I mean, I obviously know a lot about opera. So to take a class in opera was kind of like general course in opera was a bit nuts, right? So we had homework on Wozzeck, and he said, you know, he would quiz us, like, what happened here. Like, it was a kind of, like, mystery clue, I Spy book opera thing. Uh-huh. And he would be like, what happened at the end? What happened in the final scene? And then, like, you know, one of my classmates was like, oh, like, he murders her. And he's like, good. And then we, like, he was like, we're going to move on. And I was like, wait a minute. Like, wait a minute. There's, like, a boy, the son, that he's, like, hopping on a horse, and a kid runs in and says, hey, your mother's dead, and the kid keeps hopping on the horse.
Right.
And he was like, yes, but, you know, that's really after the climax of the situation. And I was like, but you asked what happened in the final scene, and, like, to me that's an extremely, that's, like, the most sick kind of perverted dramatic moment. And you see what I mean? So it's like, it's always like, I feel like in my education, oftentimes it was like, it was a game of check the boxes. And right. nobody cared to discuss the really raw, kind of bloody, interesting inner guts of how these things worked. You know, they're not all Trojan horses. It's not a wooden machine. It has, you know, works have like a kind of life to them.
I think that's interesting though, because I feel like as a performer, that performers do that kind of work all the time.
Oh, yeah.
They should be. You know, they're picking apart, like, why did Verdi set this line this certain way in order to sing it expressively and to really get into the depth of the character. So it's absolutely not like this.
If only this, because they do it six times a week and then have to have that music and that character in them while they're in line at Citibank. I mean, that's
right.
That, you know, there's something amazing and kind of sad about the fact that performers always learn the inner lives of works to a degree that can't be afforded to your average person, you know. But you're right. It is a kind of amazing thing.
But my point is that it's not like that information or that the tools to get there aren't available. You know, like right. You talk to a singer, they can talk to you. Most singers who are even remotely articulate can talk to you about what Verdi did.
Right.
That was so compelling.
But wait a second.
You know what would be
but
a great question?
No, right.
Well, this would be a great question. Line up all of the humans who have ever attempted to write an opera, the ones right. that aren't worm food, and ask them all, just one question, have you ever sung in an opera chorus before? And then see how many of them who have said right. yes made operas we like.
Yeah, because I think the act of interpreting music, and especially for the singer, is so deep and different than even composers. They find things there that even the composers don't see because they're trying to justify the emotional content that they're trying, you know, that they have inside.
Or maybe for insidious reasons, because they want to sing beautifully. So they or not insidious, but maybe for, you know, selfish reasons. They want to sing, they want to sound really good.
But what I would suggest is then, I think that an opera should be something where it's a communal activity. You have a singer sing the aria before you're done and you've really set in your ways, and have a singer tell you, you know, what they get from it. The other side of that is it'd be great for a composer to work with a singer while the singer's studying, let's say, a Verdi thing, and ask them the question, what does this line tell you about the character? And hear how a singer interprets it.
Well, we got to be careful because I'm not convinced that Verdi or Mozart. I don't think that the drama in their works is best suited by a lot of the kind of modern dramatic techniques and or ways that we investigate them. I find a lot of people doing kind of like weird, almost Stanislavski or, you know, method kind of things, method kind of treatments or talkings about Verity to be really weird. You know, that's really weird to me because that music is, again, sustained by the drama of characters who live in an emotional world that's so far from the place that that technique came from.
Right, but the singer still has to make an arc and somehow make a coherent human being character out of
it. Yeah, but it might not be in the ways that we expect music and drama and time to link up in say films, you know, because like, you know, take for example Handel's arias, which are some of those arias that, you know, he wrote of Tribazillion, and some of them are my favorite pieces of music ever, and the lyrics are, you could say, banal, but then the way that they're handled is anything but banal. And so a singer has to figure out how to make that moment come through, and it can't be about investigating what they really feel about, you know, say, the trees or whatever kind of semi-banal thing they're singing about, you know?
Yeah, but
there has to be another way that they connect with singing an aria and making sense dramatically of that moment that doesn't come from a reading of the text.
Okay, so if you're singing, I mean, I would say like Baroque music and bel canto music struggle with the same sort of thing where you're saying the same sort of really dumb text over and over and over again.
I wouldn't call it dumb. I just think that it's a lot of that text is sometimes it's dumb, of course,
right.
but more often than not, it's very simple, and it's simple for a reason, because the way that dramatic music and the way that opera was made and had an effect at that time meant that you couldn't have the kind of text that Wagner was using, or the kind of text that, you know, the kind of text that stand up to kind of literary scrutiny or whatever.
Right. And but I would argue that those were periods where it was more about the music than the text. So when you're going in to sing a bel canto aria, you're conveying the message of the aria, but more to the point, you're showing off what the music can do, right? Yeah. And so there is drama in that, but the drama is musical.
But it's also textual, right? Because you're deciding, it's textual not in the sense of deep interpretation of what the words mean, but it's deeply textual in the sense that you're deciding upon delivery, rhythm, right? And so all of those things, like that's why I kind of shirk immediately the idea that it's just a musical event. I don't want to see a Handel opera on vowels, you know.
Yeah, but I think though that the great interpreters did both, and even though the ones are tight. I mean, I know a lot of people don't like Cecilia Bartoli. I happen to really.
She's fantastic.
Thank God. All right, I'm good. Oh. I'm glad you said that, because I've said, oh, I really like what she does, and people go, what? No, I really love what she does, and what I like about it is that she's not singing notes. When I'm listening to her, it's like she figures out what reaction her character would have that would cause someone to laugh that way or to sigh that way or to whatever. Right. And she incorporates that into her arias. And I find it very, very, very
moving. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. And you know what's a great example is the, do you guys know, ah, gi, ta, da, da, do, and di? Oh my God. On YouTube is just insane. I mean, in addition to like, and that's a good example of what we're talking about. Like, there's vocal fireworks going on that are really, really dramatic. And I would hate for somebody to come along and be like, you know, tell me about this text and tell me about, because it's like, because I had that in college too. Like, I would have teachers that just were gauntless when it came to music that didn't operate along the lines of like, you know, oh, I'm singing me and I'm dying, and so I have to sing. You know what I mean? Like, if it wasn't this kind of verismo, traditional, very filmic, very 20th century or late 19th century, early 20th century way of dealing with drama, then they didn't have any idea what to tell students, you know? So they would tell them things like, oh, you're walking through a beautiful Italian field, and smile more. And it's just like, oh, we're really paying you like over $1,000 an hour?
Well, I think though that, all right, well, let's bring this into the 20th century. So maybe these composers weren't thinking of complete characters, and they were writing music, and the actors, singers come along and they create the emotional content for it. But don't you think that modern composers should be taking the what we now know about the human condition and drama? No.
They get to do whatever they want.
No, but all right. I'm thinking about, let's see.
You're charging them when you're going to give them a bill of goods? They have to make work according to specifications.
But when A View from the Bridge, for example, is such a great connection between the story, great storytelling, the emotional content, and the music, that it's overwhelming. It completely hits you. I'm not saying that all composers need to
do that. But that's just that's just a very fine opera. You can't, you know what I mean? It's very, you can't just go, hey, well, there's one guy who did it the way I like it, so hey, everybody, start whipping it up, you know?
What Peter's getting at is that many composers are not telling a story with their operas. They're sort of painting pictures. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong, inherently wrong with that.
But not everyone's doing it.
There is sort of like this, I sort of miss theater in many modern operas. And that's not, I know composers who write great narratives. Like, this is not a charge against all composers. But it is a weakness of a lot of operas that I have sung in and a lot of operas that I've seen, is that there's not a strong sense of forward motion or a strong sense of character or really anything. There's not really that sense of push and pull of time that you get with a movie or a novel or many earlier operas.
I have another idea.
Right. Okay.
I think that because I kind of understand what you're saying. I think, let's take, for example, Two Boys. I think that, which I thought was successful as an opera, like I enjoyed Two Boys a lot, but do I think it's fantastic? Are we going to see it all the time? No. Is it like, did it crack my mind open? Am I going to buy the score and keep, no, you know, but I really enjoyed it and it impressed me way more than I thought it would. And there's just a lot in that score. But I think the kind of story that he's trying to tell, I think he was trying to tell a thriller. I think that there is, on the part of composers, that they want to shock and thrill and use the language of film and use the possibilities of film. And I don't think anyone has cracked the nut of how that's going to happen with the language of opera, the language of its theater and the language of its music, and then the language of its onstage drama. I don't think anyone's... It's like people know what content they want and they actually know their materials really well, but they can't figure out a way to bring it together.
What a great discussion. And now let's switch to our discussion with Niloufar Talibi. Multidisciplinary artist. She's done amazing things translating works from Persian, as well as creating plays, performance art, and now opera. And it's a real treat to have you. It seems that that whole region of the world is very hot right now. What was the name of the thumbprint? Was that the name of the opera we saw?
Yes.
That was Kamala Sankaram. Am I saying that right? Hopefully.
Yes.
That was this past winter here. And there's also, who else is there?
Sumedha Song
by
Muhammad Fairuz.
So there's been a lot of really wonderful works done. You know, we should get you all in a room together and do a show.
Yes. I would love that.
And now I can edit it, the rest of the show from there.
Thank you so much.
And Peter, we should have that event catered so we have all food from all of those regions, please.
Lots of hummus. And Ramadanish.
Yes, please. In fact,
and let us loose.
Kamala
and I wrote, Kamala and I are in the same program at the American Lyric Theater, and she and I had, there's four librettists, four composers, and we each get matched up for a different assignment. Uh-huh. Kamala and I got the chorus assignment, and I had just traveled to Bali during Christmas time, and I let her know that I was going to use some Hindu mythology to create a a show together, you know, an assignment together. And it turned out so beautiful. She writes the most beautiful, memorable music. It was so wonderful. And if we can just start from there and just build on that, I would be so happy. Kamala's one of the smartest and multi-talented people I know, really.
Yeah. And there's a lot of energy going on right now with, you know, exotic, you know, this sort of like, no, seriously, it was, remember when, what was it, the 1920s when Bartok and there's a sort of this internationalism
Kodai.
Flowered.
Sure.
Now it's sort of happening in the Middle East, you know.
Yeah, kind of. And
of course the greater Middle East, because I think Muhammad isn't he from Egyptian background?
Yeah, Egyptian, yeah.
And then Kamala is from Indian, so it's like we just expand the idea of Middle East to like the greater Middle East, and that includes everyone.
I think she's Paki, right? She's Pakistani.
She's probably... God, she definitely looks Pakistani, Northern Indian, but I'm not sure, actually. I have to ask her.
Yeah, it's that people are more educated now than they were in Bartok's time. I mean, back then, you know, people were so, you know, enamored with exoticism and anything from the East, and you know, they knew nothing about it. But now people are actually educating themselves, and they're politically aware.
All right, let's be honest, though. How much do you know about Iran?
A lot.
Oh, you do?
Well, partly because I dated an Iranian woman, so but I guess I have an insider track. But yeah, I happen to know a fair amount. I mean, also I've seen some films out of Iran. You know, I'm familiar with traditional Persian music. I'm familiar with Iranian art. But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, general American public. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't think either of us represents the general.
Right. Yeah.
But do you think that people know the difference between? Like the Arab idea and the Persian idea, and that they're different, and or even Paki and Indian. I don't think they people generally understand the
unless
cultural.
They've had friends who've barked at them about the difference.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the difference though with Persian culture. I know the Persian culture goes way back. It's really the earliest writing, Sumerian writing. Is that considered Persian?
Well, no, that's Sumerian, but I think the geographically speaking, there was the Persian Empire that expanded and shrunk over the centuries, starting 600-700 before the birth of Christ.
Right.
So now for 2600 years, so it was a different size at different times, and now today it's the smaller country that's called Iran. Even that's changed over the last 100-150 years as the kings in the previous dynasty to the Pahlavi in the Qajar dynasty gave away a lot of land to be able to support their lifestyles. They gave away a lot of land to the Russians, and they gave away a lot of influence to the British and later on to the Americans. So, the country's changed a bit in size. Sumerian, I think the Persian Empire, because it did own, it did represent and rule over so much of the land that's now, you know, West Asia. Sumerian was also probably one of the languages that at some point was represented within that empire.
Right.
But it's not necessarily the same as the writing that we now call Persian writing.
So which did Persian writing predate the Sumerian cuneiform?
Well, I think Persian, and again, I'm not a scholar on this, but cuneiform then transformed, just in terms of the Persian language, then transformed into, I think, what's called Middle Persian. And I think that was the language at hand during the 6th century, 7th century, something like that. And then that then eventually became, after the Arab conquest of most of West Asia in the 7th century, then we adopted the Arabic script to write Persian with, and then the new language that we still speak was born. That's as much as I would know without being a scholar.
Right.
So that's why today it's written with Arabic script in Iran. Now, if you just go north of Iran to Tajikistan, they speak a very, very similar language to Persian. It's Tajik, and it's written in Cyrillic script.
Right.
So if to be able to read Cyrillic script, I could actually read that language and probably understand 90% of it, because it's actually some version of the Persian language that we speak in Iran.
Now, a lot of the stories you're working with are modern stories, but have you worked with any of the ancient
Oh, yes, Persian? I have.
How far back?
Avestan, which is the language after Sanskrit.
Wow.
So I did a project with the wonderful composer Mark Gray, And he and I were commissioned to do something for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. We were commissioned by Carnegie Hall and Cal Performances here in Berkeley, and then eventually by the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra to expand it. But the ensemble, the chamber version, we did in 2011 at Carnegie and at Cal Performances. So for that, I did about a year of research. I wanted to bring in some Zoroastrian hymns, and little did I know that Zoroastrians are amazing in the sense that their holy, their corpus, their literary work is still being written, and it's vast. There are so many books that are included in what is their religious liturgical work. So I did a lot of research to find the few passages or maybe the few lines that I wanted to include so into the story that I created. And so I ended up finding four or five lines from the hymns to the earth, Zamyod Yasht, in Avestan. So in fact, Jessica Rivera then ended up singing in Avestan as well as Persian, because then I included four or five lines from a 20th century Iranian poet, Sohrab Sepehri. So she sang in three languages, English, Avestan, which, as we might imagine, might be a dead language, but it's not. It's a living language because Zoroastrians still pray in Avestan every week.
Wow.
So let's talk a little bit about the Persian cycle, which is which you're going to be showing a segment of on May 14th here in New York City. Let me just say that at the Stone corner, corner of Avenue C and Second Avenue, New York, which is part of the Ferris Festival. Mm-hmm. Ferus, yep. Should I say?
I think it's Ferris, as in wild, the wild ones.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
Right. Vision into Arts inaugural festival that they're doing, and I'm delighted to be a part of it. I'm the only librettist in this 1 week festivity. So I just decided, when I was accepted into the American Lyric Theater program this past year and started this wonderful, amazing program that really nurtures librettists as well as composers, but I think composers have a little bit more opportunities to delve into what it is to know opera and to write opera, but librettists don't really generally have a chance to focus on that particular craft. But this is an amazing program where we studied with librettists, composers, and the wonderful dramaturg Corey Ellison. We studied operas in depth, all the building blocks of opera, and then we had these wonderful assignments, of which I spoke about my assignment with Kamala to write for the chorus. And now we're under the supervision of Mark Adamo to write our own operas. And so the one that I ended up, I'm writing this piece, this 30-minute piece with Clarice Assad, who's multi-talented performer herself, jazz musician from the infamous, Assad brothers family. Yes, she's quite amazing. I'm delighted to be working with her. So I came up with this story, and I really had no idea that I would come up with these stories. They were just sort of buried in the subconscious somewhere. So this story came out that's set in 1983 in Tehran. And so Iranians had a revolution in 1979 when the monarchy was deposed and the current Islamic Republic of Iran was established.
Right. You were actually living in Iran at that point as a child?
Yes, I was. I was living in Iran both before the revolution and after the revolution. During the revolution, I was here in the U.S. Because my school, I went to a Jewish school in Tehran, and it happened to be across the street from the University of Tehran, where there was a lot of unrest and protests and right. tear gas and all that. So in our schoolyard, there was a lot of tear gas, and it was very, very dangerous. So my parents decided to leave the country for a while in 1978 and 1979. And then after the revolution was declared, quote, victorious,
yes.
mm-hmm. My parents just decided to go back. Yes.
Now, they were living in London when you were born.
Yes, my father went to medical school there, so I was born there. But I was here in the U.S. During 1978, 1979.
Okay.
And then so we went back, and those 4 years when we lived in Iran, in 1980 started the Iran-Iraq War, Mm-hmm. And it lasted for 8 years. So this opera is set in 1983 in the thick of the war and, you know, martial law and lots of unrest while the Ayatollah Khomeini was, you know, killing off a lot of the factions that had helped win the revolution so that he could establish his own regime. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very difficult time of unrest. And so I lived in Iran between 1980 and 1984, and just I was incredibly fortunate to also have the most amazing treasure of Iranian arts and poetics, Ahmad Shamlu, also visit our home at my parents' literary salons for these 4 years. So my life was shaped during those 4 years to see, you know, war, revolution, political unrest, hear about torture firsthand from people who've been tortured, and to have this giant teach me about poetry and classical music. In fact, the reason why I'm talking to you today is not only because I studied piano when I was a child, but also because specifically he brought classical music into our home.
It's interesting because, you know, it's very formative years no matter where you are at the age you were at. You must have been 7.
I was 11 to 15 during those 4 years.
And then on top of that, living in a place under so much stress that's so dynamic would have also been very formative too. So
incredibly.
Must have been very intense.
Yes, the best 4 years of my life still to this day and the most formative years of my life just because of the influences, you know. So this opera, this story that I'm creating with Clarice is set in 1983 and it's sort of a very, very intense domestic scene. It's a one act, three scene piece and it's a fight between a husband and wife and the husband's brother about smuggling their 11-year-old boy, the 11-year-old boy of the family, out because in Iran, during the Iran-Iraq War, boys, young boys, were drafted with the promise of a plastic key made in Taiwan around their necks with a promise that they will. This is their key to heaven, where they will have 72 virgin houris and all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that they would walk these boys over the minefields so that then the soldiers could walk through.
Ugh. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Child soldiers. Totally documented. You can easily Google it and there's tons of pictures. And,
but
yeah.
Is the story you're telling an actual, is this coming from someone's biography or is it from the imagination?
It's sort of an amalgam of all the information that I was privy to growing up in this environment, the history of Iran, just a little bit about, you know, my family, a little bit about the families that I saw, stories that I've heard. It's just sort of an amalgamation. I can't really point out who's who and whether, you know, the husband is my father or my uncle or, you know, somebody I saw down the street or I can't really tell. It's just sort of forming in the subconscious. Yeah. But so it's this very, very intense dispute between these three people about whether to smuggle their 11-year-old boy outside or not, to leave Iran or not. And, you know, smuggling, you know, it's just basically entrusting your child to strangers that would then, you know, walk them for day and night, day and night. It's not easy to imagine your child being smuggled. Mm-hmm. So, but a very dramatic secret then is revealed during the course of this three-scene argument. So once I started developing the story, and Mark Adama was very, very encouraging of the story. So I then was nominated to join the librettist composer program at the WNO has, the Washington National Opera has, under their New Opera Initiative at the Kennedy Center. Mm-hmm. So then I joined that program as well, and then I was, you know, commissioned to write a 20-minute piece. And their only parameter is to write a piece that's about or set here in America. So I set a 20-minute piece that happens here in Silicon Valley. And this is also a four-person work, and it's a very intense scene that happens with two Iranian-American entrepreneurs and an artist that they've invited to their home whose painting they've bought and the maid that's just come from Iran. Mm-hmm. So this story came out and developed, and it's developing itself. And then one day I was in the swimming pool, and I realized that these two operas are related because the 11-year-old boy in one opera is the brother of one of the girls in this other opera. And then that, the idea of the, you know, of being able to then create a cycle, because there's key, very dramatic key moments in Iranian history, in modern history, from, you know, the early 1900s to today, that would make amazing operatic material, to then set this sort of a dynastic family drama against. Very much, you know, similar in a way to the way The Ring is structured, except that The Ring happens, I think, in less than 100 years. Probably happens in 10 years, maybe.
So now
maybe
there's five. Four. There's going to be four parts? Four parts to this?
Yes, I imagine four parts. I haven't worked on the first and the second parts, which would happen at very key moments in history, in Iranian history, and world history, really.
And the piece that you're doing in the city, is that The Disinherited? Is that what it's being called? Or is that the part?
It's the working title, yeah. That's the one that's set in 1983 in Tehran.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That one is being performed. It's a piano singer concert performance at Symphony Space, I think on June 16th, mm-hmm. with the American Lyric Theater. And Clarice just finished writing the music for it, the first draft. Yes.
So all four operas, would they share certain characters? There would be a through line of family or characters who know each other through all four operas?
You know what? I imagine it like that, yeah. Uh-huh. And I've done, okay. As part of my two outlines, the librettis that I'm writing, I always do character background because I was trained as a method actor. Mm-hmm. And so that's a natural thing for me to do, is to just think of the characters and with a lot of detail, in fact. So I'm now in the process of sort of going back and thinking about their grandparents and great-grandparents and how to sort of get a through line. So that's what I imagine. I'm not sure whether that is going to be the case or not, but I do know that I want to set it in the 110, 120 year history, starting from now to, you know, early 1900s.
But what sort of makes this, I was going to say triptych, it's a quiptych? No, what's four?
A quartet.
A quartet. There we go. What makes this quartet unique is that you're going to have four different composers.
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. And I really definitely want to have four different composers. And the wonderful librettist, Cerise Jacobs, is a great, thank God that there's a person like her doing. She's doing a trilogy called the Ouroboros Trilogy. Mm-hmm. And in Boston, she wrote the first one, Madame Whitesnake.
Yeah.
With a different composer. And then Paola Prestini is doing the second part of that called Gilgamesh. And then I forget the name of another composer who's doing the third part of this trilogy. So I had always imagined, you know, that I would create a story and then I would bring on composers to do this. But I'm so glad that there's actually a librettist doing this, because as you know, librettists have for a while now taken sort of a secondary role in being credited for creating these stories that we tell. It didn't used to be that way in the beginning when opera was starting off. As you might know, writers, librettists actually got the first credit and then the composers the second. Uh-huh. I'm in favor of both getting equal credit because, you know, both are working just as hard. So I'm glad to know that there are librettists that are taking the bull by the horn that way in creating stories and then bringing on key collaborators to create the stories that they want to tell.
So the American Lyric Theater, are they the ones who are helping you hook up with composers, or what role are they playing in this?
They have a program called the Composer Librettist Development Program, and it's a minimum of 1 year. And it's basically like getting a one-year master's. It's an amazing program. We had classes twice a week, you know, very methodically studying opera and having assignments. So this first version of The Disinherited is being developed under the auspices of that program and being performed. Whether they will then continue to commission the work and to foster the work, that remains to be seen. And then the Kennedy Center has commissioned the other. I don't have a title for the other one yet that's set in Silicon Valley. That we perform in November 20 and 21, I believe. And that has a small ensemble and four singers. I'm very excited about that one, too.
Now, has there been any other presentation of The Disinherited yet?
No, this is the first one, and I'm really glad that we are able to get permission to do just this the work in progress aria on Wednesday at the Stone. We're going to do one aria from the work that I already have performed, the work that I wrote with Mark Gray, which is Atash Surushan, or Fire Angels.
So does Fire Angels have a story, or is it it actually has an arc? It has one story all the way through. Okay.
Yeah, it's a song cycle, and the year that I was researching Atash Surushan, Fire Angels, I was also researching a work that I did for the LA County Museum of Art, in which I wrote it and worked with a composer to create the performance music and also performed it. And that was about the Persian New Year, which the work is called the Persian Rite of Spring. Yes. So it's called the Persian Rite of Spring. Yeah. In the same year, I was researching Fire Angels. And so I was really delving into Zoroastrian mythology. And what happened is out of that research came the two characters, Mana and Asha, which are two philosophical concepts that I personified. Mana is the divine force that inhabits everything in the universe in the Persian and Oceanic traditions. And Asha is the Zoroastrian term. It has like 35 meanings, but one of the meanings is truth and existence. So these two, in my mind, I remember the day I was driving down the street with my mother to go to the dentist, and I had all this research in my head, and the story just came to me, and I had to pull over, and my mother was gracious enough to cancel my doctor's appointment and let me just frantically write. So Mana and Asha became these two characters, you know, East and the West, and they had this really devastating encounter, and you can interpret that as, you know, the airplanes going into the building. But none of that is mentioned. It's a total double entendre libretto. It's basically these two larger-than-life sort of primordial entities that think they're the end-all and be-all of the universe, and just out of ignorance, they have this horrible encounter, and they're both devastated. They both die. They both perish. But as they're perishing, they realize, as all the masks have gone away and they're in their naked true forms, they realize that actually they're one and the same. And they sort of have this metaphysical love. And so out of that comes a transcendent last movement.
So let's talk a little bit about the audiences for your work. This is something that Iranians get to. Have you ever?
Well, so few of them. So few of them are dabbling in neoclassical music and opera. So I don't necessarily know if, you know, I do notice that I think what Iranian expatriates are generally gravitating towards are works that they can understand a little bit better, that's closer to sort of the culture that they came from, you know, Frozen at 1979, and works that sort of are derivative and perpetuating those aesthetics and sensibilities, and maybe, taking a couple of steps ahead of that. But I noticed that the general trend is to stick to what's a little bit more known. I noticed that my work, and somebody told me this a long time ago, and I had to step out and cry because it did not feel good at the time. But he said, "Oh, this is Niloufar Taleb." He was introducing me to some other Iranians, and he said, "Her work is ahead of its time." And it did not feel good. Let me tell you, it might be a compliment somewhere, but
But to them, it wasn't.
it doesn't really feel good to know that you're not necessarily able to sort of. But I think the younger generation that's grown up here might have more of an understanding. I'm not sure. Again, as you know, classical music, new classical music, opera, that's its own insular world. So all of our audiences are very specialized.
What's your guess of how people, I mean, because you have a lasting, long relationship with Iranian, is it Iranian or Iranian? What's the correct pronunciation?
I mean, I would say Iranian.
Iranian, okay. Yeah. So the Iranian diaspora, you know, you've interviewed many poets around the world, you've translated their work, you've met people who live all over the world now from Iran. How do you think they would receive this cycle? Are there any opinions in it that you think would rub people the wrong way, or do you think?
Well, it hasn't really been born into the world yet, so I'm not sure. Nobody's seen it yet, and this is really the first time I'm talking about it publicly. So that remains to be seen. But I do have to say, because I work in many different media, you know, I translate, so I'm an author. That's something that's understandable. And then I then write shows and I perform them, and they are a really great amalgamation with my Western upbringing and my Western, cultural knowledge, which not everyone is able to sort of bridge that for themselves. So because I work in such different arenas, I think that the audience that sticks with me is an audience that can go to all those places with me and have an understanding of the different things that I venture to discover and work out for myself. I do really very much hope that, Iranians do give this opera a chance. I think that my intention as an artist is always only to tell a universal story, but universal stories have to be very specific to be universal. So I'm just choosing this very specific prism to tell, to work out my work, to sort of express my creativity, only because I think that the veneer, the stories from Iran have not really been told, and they're not necessarily present in the operatic form. The two stories I know are Xerxes by Handel, and that's, an Iranian, king. And then Turandot is actually Turandocht, which is daughter of Turan. Turan in ancient Iranian mythology and in the Shahnameh is the is sort of an enemy country to Iran. Iran and Turan, they're always at war. And so Turandocht is daughter, the princess of Turan. So she's a Central Asian character in a major Western opera. Right. But these are the only two, and I think most people, even you guys, may not have really realized that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not at all.
So these stories are not necessarily told from that part of the world, and my only intention for doing that is just so we are a little bit more familiar with that part of the world, and it's not so so much of a mystery. I mean, even Joseph Campbell did so much amazing research in world mythology. He didn't really do that much work with Persian mythology,
Right. So let's just repeat the information so people know about the event. It's May 14th. It's called The Persian Cycle, which is a working title. And it's the Librettist Spotlight, 10 p.m., $15 at the door at Ferris Festival, curated by Vision into Art at the Stone Residency, the Stone, corner of Avenue C and 2nd Avenue in New York City. And if you want more information about Nilu, Nilufar.
Nilu's great. My cousins call me Nilu. Thank you.
Her website is Nilufar Talibi, Talebi, .com. And there's a lot more information there. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation, great. Peter and Walker.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, so this is another really interesting conversation, guys. That was great. So I think that's our show
today. Our show.
Awesome. Yes, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yes, this was good. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Got Stitcher? We're on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.